6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. No power frequency radio. And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan. We have an exciting conversation planned in the next hour. We'll be speaking with UW-Madison Professor Emeritus Stanley Cutler. Many of you know Dr. Cutler's larger body of work, but in recent times he's made history in his efforts to successfully sue the National Archives and the Nixon administration to release virtually all of the secretly recorded Nixon tapes and brought them into the historic record and into a place where the public can easily access them. Dr. Cutler is the author of Abuse of Power, The New Nixon Tapes, a book that once again resulted from this ongoing series of successful lawsuits against the National Archives and the Nixon family foundation, and which again succeeded in forcing the release of these long suppressed tapes. He's also the author of The Wars of Watergate, The Last Crisis of Richard Nixon, a 1992 book, The American Inquisition, and Privilege and Creative Destruction, The Charles River Bridge Case, Judicial Power and Reconstruction Politics, Supreme Court and the Constitution, a variety of books and analysis that he's provided in many formats over the years to tell us kind of the story of American democracy. And, of course, the Watergate era, now that we're marking the 40th anniversary of many of these events, is one of the most important eras of history to reexamine and to look at the resonances that appear here today. Dr. Cutler, thank you so much for joining us here on A Public Affair.
You're welcome.
It's good to have you here, and if you could, why don't we start in a basic place, recent events. Could you talk about the lawsuit that you had launched against the National Archives and the state of Richard Nixon? Why was there resistance to release of this information?
Well, the resistance was from Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon is now would now be 100 years old. I can assure you, if Nixon were alive, we still would not have the tapes. He was going to resist in any way imaginable or possible. I've estimated a rough figure in 1970s and 80s and 90s dollars how much he spent on using lawyers to fight these things. A ballpark figure between $10 and $20 million. This is why he kept writing books, because to feed his lawyer habit. And not until he was gone were we going to get those tapes. And once he was gone, then it was an easy matter, because my lawyer said, how are you going to go on resisting now? There was no more money. The estate, the Nixon estate, aside from the money for his family, was broke and could no longer fight these things. So 2 years after his death, they settled up, and things, the first couple hundred hours were released. And it's been 15 years now. There have been undue, unnecessary delays as they insisted upon more rechecking of the state tapes to make sure they were accurate and so forth, and not that there were any transcripts. These were just delaying tactics, and seeing I was no longer actively using them, I would only occasionally prompt things, but I knew we would eventually get them, and we did. There are still some tapes that are suppressed on the grounds of personal politics or personal family matters. We'll see. Some of those will eventually be released.
I know that one of your intentions was to make them publicly accessible, and one of the initial obstacles to that was that people actually had to travel to the Nixon Library to hear the tapes.
I think aside from getting the tapes, the most important provision in our settlement was that after January 1, 2000, the tapes could be there could be discs made of the conversations, and they could be, and they would be released to the public. In other words, you could play them anywhere. More importantly, you could play them on at the air and television and so forth, because they're public property. Now, until that date, though, Nixon had a court order that restrained people from using them publicly, but they're now available to anybody. When I did the book, you had to travel to Washington. You had to listen to it in one little room on equipment that was probably archaic by the 1960s. And therefore, you know, the sound wasn't that good. They've all been digitalized now, so they're much easier to hear and understand.
You know, there's been a lot of talk in the news recently about efforts that are very, very well orchestrated to kind of gloss over any kind of imperfections in the Reagan administration. But it strikes me that Richard Nixon, after resigning in 74, what was really part of an effort to try to reconcile himself with the American people, to try to redeem himself. And it sounds like your battle was a part of that.
Richard Nixon's last campaign
was
his campaign for history.
Right.
And but I always was amused. Every time Richard Nixon would write another book, and, you know, people would say, well, he's back, he's making a comeback. Within about 2 weeks, Johnny Carson would start with the joke.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a certain side to Nixon that's comic. By that I mean unintentionally funny. If I say to you, I am not a crook, you know, that's one of the funniest one-liners in American political history.
That's right.
And people laugh. So, you know, he was always trying to come back, and his foundation is engaged full-time in trying to, I don't want to say rehabilitate, because they would argue they don't have to rehabilitate him. But it's an ongoing thing. And, you know, history is written to be revised in many ways. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of revision to come on this, that in future generations they may not take Richard Nixon's crimes not as serious, that they would say, well, those folks in the 70s overreacted. To which I say, you were to rot in the 70s, that's all.
Yeah. Well, you know, part of that effort to recreate history happened in 1977 with the David Frost interviews. David Frost, of course, long time.
When who?
David Frost. And,
oh, yeah.
And, of course, David having passed away recently. Do you think that
was? Yes, I know.
Was that a successful effort on Nixon's part in some level to redeem himself?
I was amused by the reaction to David, Sir David's. Passing. I have to call him that because we used him in our programs that'll be in this series called Nixon's the One that's going to play on British television this winter, and then I hope it's over here. When David Frost interviewed Nixon, now, you know, there are two David Frost interviews with Nixon. There's the one written by the playwright, and there's the one that actually happened.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you look at the DVD of the play, Frost Nixon, you know, it's clear. David Frost beat Nixon. He forced him to confess, say he was sorry, and so forth. But if you watch the original interview, that doesn't happen at all. Doesn't happen at all. There is no way David Frost forced Richard Nixon to apologize and so forth. You know, after all, to me, the most memorable remark that Nixon makes in that interview is when he says, when the president does it, it's not illegal. So what's he confessing to?
That's right.
He believed that whatever he did was not illegal because he was president. He gave himself a kind of a divine or royal afflatus to say this. But Frost did beat Nixon, I assure you of that. And but you know, indeed, that was a one of Nixon's first comeback efforts. And, you know, he won a lot of friends on that as a result of those programs. He did, to some extent, rehabilitate himself. Well, rehabilitated himself with people who really had believed in Nixon and then did no longer believe and then believed again. But, you know, as I said, It was an ongoing effort. I like to call it his last campaign, and it was his campaign for history.
And you've touched on this in interviews, but the special quality of the Nixon tapes, other presidents had also recorded their conversations, but they had a toggle switch to that they were in control of the moment that Nixon's.
That's what makes the Nixon tapes so unique as a historical document. Lyndon Johnson, John F. Kennedy, Eisenhower, Truman, they recorded when they wanted to record. And there just is not the spontaneity here. We've never heard any president so subject himself to understanding and exposure as Nixon does on these tapes. They're strongly candid, but you know, on the other hand, unless you know how to use them, you can get tricked.
Yeah. Now,
for example, there are conversations that I tell you are contrived. Let me give you an example. There was something that happened. It's not silly to go into what happened, but Haldeman comes in and tells Nixon about this, and Nixon says, "Oh my God," you know, and so forth. You know, he knows all about it, but he doesn't know that the news is going to become public. Then his attorney general comes in and says, "Mr. President, I've got to make this public." Oh, terrible, you know, and so forth. About a half hour later, John Dean, who's rather a low-level consul at the time, comes in and says, "Mr. President, I just found out about this." Next says, "You did? Well, what is this? Tell me." You know, it's as if he acts as if he'd never heard of this before, he has no knowledge of this. Well, Nixon always contended that the tapes would exonerate him. Indeed, they would have exonerated him if he could have only dealt with these contrived conversations and eliminated the others. But he, of course, did get that chance.
I'm not surprised, but we already have some callers on the line, and we want to get to this in a second. I do want to punctuate something we'll come back to in just a moment. You're mentioning some of the fictional depictions. Of course, you have a play that's debuting this month called I, Nixon. We'll come back to that in just a second, I promise.
Okay.
But first, let's go to our callers. And caller, your comment or question, please.
Hi. Mr. Cutler, I've heard you comment on various things over the years, and I remember a number of years ago, it's probably been 20 years or so, I think you suggested the erase sections of the tapes, the infamous silent stretch, could have been restored for like $100,000. Later, I think you had said something to the effect that the family in the library are fighting you with as much intensity as they can muster to prevent that from happening. I was just curious if you could give an update on where that stands today and if you still feel that the technology is there to restore that section of tape. And it's good to hear your voice. Thanks.
Oh, yeah, thank you. You mean the 18 and a half minutes? Is that what you mean?
I believe that is what he meant. I think.
Yeah, well, you know, this is a media thing, how they exaggerate this and so forth. Listen, the 18 and a half minutes is part of like an hour and a half ongoing conversation that occurs when Richard Nixon comes back from Florida couple of days after the Watergate break-in, and his chief of staff, Haldeman, is briefing him and telling him how they're trying to contain the whole thing. It's there that we have the famous smoking gun comments, you know, that will use the CIA to keep to fend off the FBI. Well, there's this section that's missing, but it's clear that that section is just more of the same. I just don't believe there's anything there of significance. And there have been people that have wasted time, money, and energy trying to restore that. I just can't believe there's anything of importance that will come out of that.
This may be mythology, but there is something written that tape and somehow that the information that's underlying the re-recording, it's in a climate-controlled facility and some future technology might be restored. But it sounds like you just don't think there's really any value and it's overblown.
Well, I just don't know. People send me long essays about what they're trying to do and so forth. And because I just don't believe there's anything of importance in that, I have my own theory how it happened. here's my theory. You know, when the tapes, we first got knowledge of the tapes, and Nixon started to listen to some, it's the missing 18 and a half minutes has a lot of constant pressing of the button to try to delete and so forth. It was clear at the time, as the technician said, that somebody who didn't really know how to operate a tape recording machine was doing this. Well, there was only one obvious candidate for that, and that was Nixon. And my theory is that he started out trying to eliminate damaging conversations, and it became a hopeless chore. It became a hopeless chore because, you know, we're dealing with a couple thousand hours of tape. How could he go by himself, go through it, and eliminate this stuff? Hmm. So, you know, I know people will always fool around with this. It's just not my thing.
Well, it sounds like there's plenty of grist beyond that to delve into. So I guess we have another caller on the line. Caller, your comment, your question.
Thank you.
Yeah, hello?
Yes, please, go ahead.
Oh, sure. I wanted to get into this interesting subject about the rehabilitation of Nixon. The reason I'm so curious is I lived through this whole period of Watergate, and, you know, listening to you talk about it, it's reminiscent, but it also seems so quaint at this point. I mean, as far as Nixon being rehabilitated, he's had to do very little. The change in the times has essentially almost rehabilitated him, because when you compare Nixon to, say, somebody like Clinton, I mean, Nixon almost appears in the light of time now to be progressive. He did things like create the EPA. He had some fairly progressive ideas on welfare.
Yeah, well.
He had other innovative ideas, too, I believe, on other aspects of both foreign and diplomatic policy, although I don't give him credit for opening up to China. That was strictly opportunistic events that were changing in the Sino-Soviet conflict that made that possible. But what would you have to say about the fact that just the change in times have almost made Nixon now look almost progressive compared to some of the presidents that have served since him? I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks for an interesting program.
Yeah, well, let me begin by quoting myself, a line I use in my play that I have Nixon say, where he says that the function of every president is to make his predecessor look good. He says, this is my writing. Nixon says, "Why, hell, I even made Harry Truman look good." And indeed he did. But then you've had people who have succeeded Nixon. And at one point, some of my friends were telling me, "I miss Nixon." that by comparison, well, of course, but that doesn't absolve you from dealing with the man himself. And you raise a number of points that we could deal with, that people like to talk about in terms of Nixon's rehabilitation. First of all, you mentioned China, and as you said, it was opportunistic. I always say that Richard Nixon was able to go to China. I'm sorry, President Nixon was able to go to China because he didn't have Richard Nixon on the outside looking in to criticize him. If anybody else had tried that, he would have been the first in line to criticize him. You mentioned the EPA. That's always amused me. The EPA is passed 2 months after Nixon becomes president. Well, the EPA had been floating its way through Congress, sponsored by some senator from Wisconsin named Gaylord Nelson, for a number of years. So and Nixon, in his private conversations on the tapes, mocks environmentalists and people who advance that cause. He thinks a lot of them are silly people. Now, my friend and colleague here in town, Ralph Andriano, contends, and I agree with him, that Nixon may have presented the most far-reaching program for health care reform. And in fact, I mean, the Obama administration took parts of that, but didn't go as far as Nixon did. So then, of course, you know, there are other things you could mention that are really what I call fighting ground for not partisans, but for historians to debate over, you know, how much good, what was it, right, and so forth. But what I would argue is that Richard Nixon was the man who matters to us today, that so much of what he did is still affecting us today. For example, closing of the gold window in 1971, foreign policy, his success in 1972 in really labeling the Democratic Party as the party that was weak on national security. These things are still with us, and we still debate them, our health care reform, the EPA, and so forth. So Nixon is, I'll take it one step further. I would argue, this is not the place to do it at length, I would argue that Richard Nixon is the most significant political figure of the last 60 years. That what he did, what he said, is still part of our culture. Look at, for example, Nixon finally pulls off realigning the solid South, solid Democratic at one time. Nixon flips it. Look what he does with the Supreme Court, the placing of William Rehnquist on the court, a man who was committed to overthrowing much of the 20th century version of constitutional law. But what Rehnquist did and his successor, John Roberts, who was his clerk, doing has decidedly altered this landscape. So when I say, you know, tell me, who, of course there are these people who say Reagan is more important, which I find silly. Johnson is important indeed, so much domestically, but so little of it is left today. Kennedy was president for less than 3 years and simply did not accomplish much that is with us. He brought a style that people think is important. Well, I deal with substance, not style. But this, Nixon is the man who matters.
I don't know if this enters into the area of substance or style, but if you talk about developments that have come to light recently about ALEC and about sort of a concerted way to bring more and more money and power into an elite few, other things, are those approaches kind of working and stretching the system? Are those Nixonian concepts in some ways?
Well, Nixon brought us the enduring campaign. You know, he becomes president in January of 69. He's writing memos to his staff. He dictates these long things. He dictates them at night in the White House about preparing for the 72 campaign. He just got in office. Well, look at today. Look what we do today. It's 2013, and all the media wants to talk about is 2016 because they got to fill 24/7 of news, and they're talking about 2016.
Yeah,
the candidates, and so forth. It's absurd.
It's certainly a more substantial time in a lot of ways, and it'd be fun to explore that a bit. But you know, one of the things, of course, it strikes me about you know, when the Nixon transcripts were first released.
No transcripts.
I'm sorry? I'm thinking back
there,
to...
There are no transcripts.
Okay.
The only transcripts that existed are the ones made by the special prosecutor. But that's only about 30 hours. The rest, there, if you go listen to the Nixon tapes, there are no transcripts.
Mm-hmm.
You have to transcribe yourself. And I can assure you that if three of us are in the room listening to a tape... we may all agree on the gist of the conversation, but precise word for word, there'll be some differences.
What I'm thinking back to is when those first 30 hours were released and, you know, books came out with the transcripts, people saw and I think were surprised by the candid nature of the conversation, the informality,
Sure.
Of course, you know, the profanity, but also... I guess, you know, trying to analyze, was Nixon someone who was prejudiced? Was he anti-Semitic? What were his views on race relations?
See, that's just it.
Yeah.
Here we have There is no time or way we have ever been in a president's skull mm-hmm. the way we are in Nixon's. But I can assure you, you don't think he was alone in that kind of language, do you?
No, no.
You don't want me to describe my interview with Harry Truman. And then, you know, there's a wonderful line in this movie, The Butler.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, there's a wonderful line. It's showing Lyndon Johnson addressing Congress for Voting Rights Act. You know, it's a great speech because Johnson understood that the issue was exploitation and mastery of one group by another. And he speaks very candidly about it. But he keeps speaking about the Negro. And one of the butlers was watching this, and he says, "Well, man," he said, "that man uses the N-word more than I do."
That's right.
So, you know, the language is not shocking, except the problem is that with Nixon, it goes on and on and on, and it doesn't look good many times.
There's another scene in The Butler when Nixon was vice president, approaching the three butlers together and, you know, and asking for their support. And, you know, he was painting himself potentially as a civil rights advocate. Yeah, yeah. You just, you know, I mean, when you talk about Nixon, was that a contradiction? Or was that real?
Did he believe? I would remind you.
Yeah.
And in 1960, when he runs against Kennedy, two prominent supporters are a man named Jackie Robinson. The other is a man named Martin Luther King Sr.
Hmm.
Who were backing him. Oh no, he had some interesting ties then. But what happens after 1968? He makes his choices. He's going to go with the White South, and realign the South. But that's all true. The way it's presented on screen is those of us who live in the other world call artistic license.
I know that I'm painting with a broad,
basically true.
I'm painting with a broad brush here, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is, were there things that Nixon, you know, if he thought of himself as a brave civil rights advocate, pioneering, or thought of himself as ahead of the curve on some of the progressive things that were mentioned here, was that something he really believed himself, or was that something, it was a way he was pulling the wool over people's eyes that he was one thing and really something else?
It's always hard to disentangle Richard Nixon's real beliefs and when he's operating with a political calculus. You know, he's weighing what's good for him politically. And, in the 60s, after his defeat as president, he really changes in many ways. If he had become president in 1960, I don't think we would have had Watergate. But that's another matter. But Nixon was convinced that he beat Kennedy every which way in the debates. But he realized that he spent so much time, he wanted to debate substance and not rhetoric, not style. And he realized why he lost those debates. And he realized that it was largely a waste of to speak too much of substance in these things.
We'd like to give our listeners just a little bit of a hint of some of these tapes, encourage folks to go and explore them more of their own. You'll find a lot of this at the sites of the National Archives, the Nixon Presidential Library. I guess one of the discoveries I made this morning is the museum out of Washington, D.C. is actually categorized these a little bit easier. And you touched on this, but I think part of the challenge of trying to get into these clips is they not necessarily real well indexed, and so trying to get at the more interesting clips is a bit of a challenge. But it's of course recognized as so crucial to what happened is what's called a smoking gun tape. I believe this is just a few days after the Watergate break-in in June of 1972. And let's, if we could, just play a few excerpts from the beginning of that.
The investigation, you know, the Democratic break-in thing. We're back in the problem area. they have, their investigation is now leading into some productive areas because they've been able to trace the money, not through the money itself, but through the bank, you know, sources, the banker stuff, and it goes some directions we don't want it to go. Also, there have been some things like an informant came in off the street to the FBI in Miami with a photographer who has a friend who's a photographer who developed some films for this guy, Parker. And the films had pictures of Democratic National Committee letterhead documents. So he's got, there's things like that that are, that are filtering in. Mitchell came up with yesterday, and John Dean analyzed very carefully last night and concurs now with Mitchell's recommendation that the only way to solve this, and we're set up beautifully to do it, in that, and that's the only network that paid any attention to last night was NBC, who did a massive story on the Cuban thing and all. That the way to handle this now is for us to have Walters call Pat Gray and just say, stay the hell out of this. This is there's business here. We don't want you going any further on. That's not an unusual development. And that would take care of it. Pat does want to. He doesn't know how to, and he doesn't have any basis for doing it. Given this, he will then have the basis. He'll call Mark Felt in, and the two of them, and Mark Felt wants to cooperate because he's ambitious. Yeah. They'll call them in and say, we've got the signal across the river to put the hold on this. And that'll fit rather well because the FBI agents who are working the case at this point feel that's what it is.
And just by way of context, I think we'll stop that right now because the clip goes on for another several minutes. I mean, we were hearing mostly the voice of Bob Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff. Again, this was just a few days after the break-in, and he clearly giving Nixon the lowdown on what was an ongoing cover-up, and Nixon in this transcript.
Well, the cover-up that had just begun.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And then, of course, Nixon acceding to and you know, essentially approving it as the tape moved on. Actually, just to cue up the engineer, if we could, selection, jump ahead a bit to what I've got captioned, I think, is the drunken Nixon and Haldeman, April 73, which you hear Nixon's voice a little bit more. To go back to, for those who maybe don't know this history, it was the Watergate hearings being held by the Senate in 1973. Alexander Butterfield, an aide to Richard Nixon, revealed the presence of this taping system, which was quite a shock to the nation. I think it was a shock that he was being asked. This is what eventually led to these tapes, which were essentially, is it right, the downfall of the Nixon presidency?
Well, fortunately for all of us, Alexander Butterfield was not going to perjure himself.
Yeah.
He was asked a question, is there tape in the Oval Office at all? But Butterfield was one of two aides besides the Secret Service who knew about this. And Alex... I call him Alex. I've since come to know him, a terrific man. He just the reason why he told was because he knew, the committee knew something. They didn't know specifics, but they knew something. And he was not about to perjure himself. He was asked a direct question, is there tape in the Oval Office? And Alexander Butterfield said yes. So...
If we could, I just want to jump ahead again, just give folks, again, some of the flavor of this. And, of course, to hear Nixon's voice himself, again, I think one of the other clips that's especially illuminating is this clip that was taped in April of 73. Nixon had just given a nationwide address on the subject of Watergate, but was clearly feeling very, very angry, burnt out about the whole subject. Again, he's confiding in Haldeman, kind of how he's feeling. And this does have a bit of spicy language, but this is to be expected, of course. So Richard Nixon and Chief of Staff Bob Haldeman.
April 30th.
Hi. Hope I didn't let you down.
No, sir. You got your points over, and now you got to set right and move on. You're right where you ought to be.
Well, it's a tough thing, Bob, for you, for John, the rest, but God damn it, I'm never going to discuss this son of a bitching Watergate thing again. Never, 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 never. Don't you agree?
Yes, sir. You've done it now, and you've laid out your position, you've laid out your, you've taken your steps, you've put the...
Interesting thing, you know, we haven't heard of the only cabinet officer that is called, and this is 50 minutes after the thing is over, is Cap Weinberger, bless his soul. All the rest, you know, are waiting to see what the polls show. Goddamn strong cabinet, isn't it?
Oh, you better check and be sure, because that they may, you know, we've had a...
No. They know who to call, you know. They know they can get through. But in any event, I just want you to know that Cap called, and he was all the way.
Good.
But let me say, you're a strong man, God damn it, and I love you. And I, you know, I love John.
We're...
All the rest, and by God, keep the faith. Keep the faith. You're going to win this son of a bitch.
Absolutely.
You notice what I said about the violence and so forth on the other side.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some intricacies in this that only the sophisticates will understand.
I got those, and I want to get the text because there's some things to work on from there. But
right.
That we can build.
I thought it was good too to sort of end on what I deeply felt. You know, the religious note. You know,
yes.
God bless America.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure. Must have, you know, driven you up the wall. Didn't drive me up the wall, but I felt that way.
I know that I'm all for that. Completely agree.
I don't know whether you can call and get any reactions and call me back, you know, like the old style. Would you mind?
I don't think I can.
I agree. I don't
have an odd spot to try and do.
Don't call a goddamn soul. The hell with it. Let me just say, getting this call from you, I mean, I haven't heard from any cabinet officer except Weinberger an hour afterwards, and thank God, and no staff member.
Well, now when I called, the board said they were instructed not to put any calls through. So
the hell with that. I told them to put all the calls through.
Well,
Professor Cutler, your thoughts on what that tells us about Nixon?
Could I make two comments about that?
Please.
Well, first of all, that's a part of a series of conversations. You know, Nixon has just fired Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Dean, and so forth. And the conversations go on that evening. And it is the only time that I would bet money that Nixon was having trouble with his alcohol that evening. There are too many slurred words in all that. And but that's the one time that I really would think so. The other thing is, I was amused at the end. He was talking about goddamn and damn and hell and so forth. Do you remember the term expletive deleted?
Oh yeah,
that was the first transcripts that came out. They were done in the White House at first, and he released these transcripts, and they have all this expletive deleted and so forth. Well, it turns out that it was Nixon himself who was deleting those things, and he was deleting words like damn, hell, goddamn, and so forth. Because, you see, Nixon, what's going on here is a violent clash between the image that Nixon had projected for 30 years of, you know, Mr. Goody Two-Shoes, Mr. Law and Order, and so forth. He once, in the debate with Kennedy, it was really funny. He said, you know, it's really nice that we have a president now, meeting Eisenhower, who uses good language, not like Harry Truman. What do you think about that, Mr. Kennedy? Kennedy said, well, I think that's Mrs. Truman's problem. It was uproarious. But he was arguing, you know, Eisenhower did use language like that. Excuse me, Eisenhower spent his lifetime in the military. Eisenhower knew how to swear. So Nixon here, he's deleting all these, and they're relatively harmless things, you know. So I think it's kind of amusing. Well, anyhow.
What I was wondering about, and maybe this was distorted by this isolated example of hearing a drunken Nixon, but it was the paranoia, you know, that is at this beginning of this conversation. I only heard from Caspar Weinberger. The rest of the cabinet seems to be waiting to see the polls before they're going to get in touch with me. Yeah, I don't think that was necessarily his support hadn't crumbled in April of 73, but you had a very paranoid man who was convinced that he was already very alone. Is that right?
The truth is that by April 8, 1973, more than a year before he resigned, Nixon knew he was in deep trouble.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, there are too many other comments. He knew because he knew what happened. He knew that he had said in the White House that, yes, we have to pay Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt, but it's worth it. You know, it was cover-up money. He knew what he had done. He still was a lawyer. He knew what he had done. Had done wrong. So these lamentations in April 73, this self-pity, it's for a reason, because he knows the probable outcome of all this.
We knew the time would fly, and we were down to about our last 12 minutes. And actually, if we engineer could queue up our next clip, it's a compilation of Nixon's best clips, I think is the way I labeled it. And we'll come to that in just a second. I did want to return to your play. So this is exciting for you. It's an off-Broadway play that's making several appearances.
Yes, in 2 weeks.
And it's called I, Nixon?
2 weeks from today, in fact. It's at the HP Theater, which Madison native Uta Hagen was a co-founder of.
Ah.
I'm very, very pleased. They got cast of impressive New York actors. They're known in New York. Joe Bologna and his wife Renee Taylor. They're known in New York, so forth. Well, Joe Bologna has had a lot of that.
He's been pervasive on television a lot too. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Well, anyhow, I'm excited about this. Now, what this is a stage reading. This is not, you know, a full production, but the idea is to see how it works, and you know. The theater itself may decide, or there will be people there, producers, directors, looking for properties. So who knows? I do know this. If I ever had any aspirations for a show business career, which I did,
uh-huh.
My late colleague George Mossy once said to me, Stanley, we don't teach. We perform. teaching is an act of theater, he argued. But I'm glad I didn't choose this as a career. I think it would have been a dead man long ago because it's such a frustrating thing, you know. You meet very few people who could really make a decision, so forth. But it's been an interesting adventure for me.
And of course, it should be noted that you
very pleased with this.
You have been involved in a lot of different satirical things through British television.
Again.
And I was just going to say, it should be noted that, of course, you have been involved with your co-creator of a show called Nixon's the One, a biting television comedy that talks about his conversations with Henry Kissinger. And also, you were part of something that airs on the British network.
Yes. This I did this with Harry Shearer.
Right.
Who some of your audience might know is the man of Spinal Tap and a man of many voices, who's a child actor and so forth, an incredibly talented man. In fact, he's touring England now in a new play. But he plays Nixon, and nobody plays. Well, I've been associated with Harry for 30 years, and he started doing his Nixon imitations on me then, and he sort of leaves me on the floor. And then we have a great actor who does Henry Kissinger better than Henry Kissinger.
Oh, wow.
And it's really a fun thing. Now, the problem is, these episodes are all introduced by David Frost, so they're either going to retain them or they're going to wash them out. I don't know. They're going to decide this week. But the show is scheduled for this winter, and then, you know, the ideas that American networks and stuff, HBO, Showtime, come over, look at it and decide whether to buy it.
Sounds like that.
Yeah, but I've done other things. You know, I worked, well, with Madison native Cyrus DeRosta, who's a superb filmmaker. Mm-hmm. He did a good television film called The Day Reagan Was Shot, and I worked with him on that. Now, I'm proud of that. I've done other things, but nothing with the full involvement of my time and energy as this this play thing.
Professor Cutler, we do have a couple of other callers, so we want to
sure.
squeeze them on. Yeah, caller, your comment or question, please, for Professor Stanley Cutler.
Thank you. The image that sticks with me is the Herb Blotter cartoon of Nixon sticking his head up out of the manhole cover and with that tremendous sneer on his face. Would you comment on the role of that cartoon in the political process? Thank you.
Did you guess the context of that question, Dr. Cutler?
Well, I didn't understand the question.
He was referring to a Herb Block cartoon with Nixon kind of poking his head up above with that famous sneer, and he just wondered if that had greater cultural significance. So that, or perhaps Nixon's caricature was such a...
That was when, the term Tricky Dick started and so forth. That's the image that a lot of people have. That is absolutely right. Cartoons during this period are so great. There was Herb Block, of course, but there was Paul Conrad in the L.A. Times. He's got a whole book of these. They're superb. My favorite, it shows Nixon wrapped up like a mummy, and he's wrapped up in recording tape that say Haldeman, Dean, Ehrlichman, and so forth. The idea that Nixon is trapped by his own, he can't get out from under his own recordings. And I just thought it was a superb cartoon. But the man is absolutely right. That image that Herb Block gave us, the man emerging from the sewer and so forth. But it's interesting. When Nixon became president, that day, Herb Block published another cartoon, and it showed a barber chair. And it said, it didn't show Nixon, but it said something about Nixon. But anyhow, Herb Block said, everybody's entitled to a clean shave. In other words, we're going to start all over. Well, that goodwill did last too long.
All right. We want to squeeze in our last caller, please. Your comment or question.
Sure.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly relate a family story. Back in the late 70s, my aunt started a sheep farm up in northern Wisconsin, and the dairy farm family took them under their wing. And they told them in the first winter, they said, now, when you get lambs, don't name them, because you're just going to feel terrible when they go to market. And, of course, they came and checked on them about a month later, and they had four lambs. And she said, now, you didn't name them, did you? And she said, well, I couldn't help myself, but I named them Ehrlichman, Haldeman, Mitchell, and Dean. So I won't feel so bad when they...
when they go to slaughter. All right. Thank you, caller. That
was
certainly a note we didn't plan on touching on, but thank you. Professor Carlos, we close out our last few minutes. I was talking to Molly Stentz, our news facilitator ahead of this. And, one of the things we were remembering, of the time 40 years ago is thinking of those press conferences, thinking of the folks who stood up, to Nixon, we're assuming their roles as members of the Fourth Estate. You don't necessarily see that in press conferences now. Having said that, actually, I wanted to come back to something you alluded to in our pre-air conversation. You were saying in some ways your battle wasn't just against the National Archives, but it was also Bob Haldeman was in some ways part of who you had to overcome.
Well, he sort of stayed out of it. The battle was with the Archives. When we filed suit, it was against the Archives, but the next day Richard Nixon handed in papers called Richard M. Nixon Intervenor. So he's part of the title of the case.
Yeah, I apologize. I think I misspoke. I meant to say Bob Woodward, by the way. Please go ahead.
I got, you can imagine, all the assistance I got from the Fourth Estate. Do you know that the Reporters Committee on Documentation, they refused to help me? They refused to help me. At all.
What?
Did Bob Woodward ever go do this? No. I stood alone then. One time famous historian from Wisconsin named Steve Ambrose said to me in his best stentorian voice, Stanley, this is the most unprofessional thing you could do. I looked at him and I said, are you crazy? This is the most professional thing I could do. What are we all about but except getting our access to sources and so forth?
Yeah.
I'm proud of what I did. That's all.
Do you feel where does this hold it in terms of its place in history? I mean, we talk about things like the Progressive magazine and its First Amendment case in the late 70s. Does it hold up to that kind of history making status, you think?
Well, I don't know. I'd rather not comment there.
So. Sure. Okay. No, it's all right. As we close out here, are you optimistic that there are lessons of Watergate that we're still carrying forward, that we can still learn things from that era?
Well, you know, I'm optimistic that there is still interest in but now, you know, we have younger generations who weren't around, but I find that there's interest. They're trying to, they understand it as an important event, and I'm optimistic that we will continue to treat it that way. After all, I argued that Watergate was the most serious constitutional confrontation we had since the Great Depression and then the Civil War. I mean, I don't compare it to the Civil War, of course, but in terms of how we were going to bring accountability to power. And to me, it's a very, very important event. I mean, by trade, I'm a constitutional legal historian. So I view it all as a serious constitutional question.
All right. Dr. Okay. Gutter, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
A very
You're welcome.
Conversation.
Thank you very much. Bye
thank
now.
You. Thank you. Goodbye. Again, we've been hearing from UW-Madison Emeritus Professor Stanley Cutler about the release of the Nixon tapes. It's a case that culminated in its final stages just a couple of weeks ago. And I encourage you to check those out through the National Archives or the Nixon Presidential website online. Thank you, all callers, for making this a fascinating discussion.